Good evening. Welcome to the Borgo Pass Horror Podcast. Enter freely and of your own will. In this episode, you may find many strange things, for the films to be discussed are old, and they have many memories. So, beware. Beware.
Welcome back to part two of our special two-part episode on Godzilla 1954. We now return to my conversation with Tony Salvaggio.
So we should probably talk about the suit for just a second. And the anecdote I've heard, and I think this is related by Haruo Nakajima, the original suit actor, was that, you know, they designed the costume, they designed the look of Godzilla, and they sculpted it, molded it in latex and rubber, cast it, and then the first time they're doing tests, they put Nakajima-san in it, and then they're like, okay, now move, and he doesn't move, and they're like, move, and he doesn't move, and they're like, maybe he can't hear us in the thing, and they take the head off, and he's like, no, you cast the rubber so thick, it's like I'm literally unable to move it at all. He's just trapped in this, in like solid rubber.
Whoa. So he can't. That had to be kind of scary too.
Right? I know, first for a second, this is Haruo Nakajima is the guy who plays Godzilla in the suit in this, and famously, I mean, anytime any kind of suit wearing stuff is hard and stuff, but this is a special, unique type of hell that again, you know, a lot of the Godzilla stuff is shot slow motion, and I talk about this a lot, where you know, if you're shooting a normal film is shot at 24 frames a second, and you shoot slow motion, you overcrank, back in the days how we described it, to make things seem bigger, so things seem slower and stuff. So, but there's math involved in where if you shoot it instead of 24, if you shoot it 200 frames a second, right, and just make Godzilla look like he's lumbering and moving and all heavy, now because your shutter has to be twice the speed of the frame rate, so your shutter now has to be 1/400th of a second, which is fast, which means you need an incredible amount of light to be able to shoot that slow motion stuff, which means more lights, which means heat, especially back in these days. So not only is this guy trapped in the suit, but he's under not even normal hot studio lights. He's under blazing hot studio lights. The constitution it takes to be able to do this kind of thing while encased in the thing and barely being able to see and all that stuff like that, it's just incredible. And I do love that you see some shots, some stills where, like, when Godzilla is just stomping on stuff and you only see like his feet, where it's Nakajima just wearing the pants and the feet, and he's got like suspenders on, and he's just doing the thing.
I love those shots, those, by the way. There was a G.I. Joe, you know, original tall G.I. Joe before it became, you know, the small ones guys that we know in the 80s. There was a kind of a version, I don't think it was directly G.I. Joe, but there was a, could have been, I have to look again, but there was a man in suit. There was a Nakajima kind of Godzilla suit.
Oh, really? Oh, cool.
Of that. Yeah, you look it up. It's really cool.
Oh, that's really neat.
Like, oh man, I kind of want one
that,
of those.
That Mego style, like.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, doll, yeah. Right? Mego style. Okay, yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's cool. Nice.
You know, when also the other thing that you have to, I don't know how much they did of it here, but we're kind of getting into the territory of like, how do you make these effects look right? On the making of or the commentary of Daimajin, they talk about how much particulate you have to put in the air to make the air look
right. You have to fog it like crazy.
Like,
so you get what's called atmospheric perspective, which is why mounds in the distance look blue, because while you're looking through, while air looks clear, it's not totally clear. There's matter in the air.
Right.
So so it's fogged up like crazy too, all that stuff.
Insane that when you think about like what you have to go through to do this and to get to get the acting to come across as somewhat believable, that's a special, there's a reason why only a few people were able to do this.
Exactly.
That's a special talent that I think when we go, ha ha, man in a suit, we're not taking that into account. Like,
it's,
do you know how hard this is?
It's
and
one
again,
of
the viewer doesn't have to worry about that, but like,
yeah, It's one of those things you want to say, like, let's see you do it. Like, really, let's see you do it. Because, wow. Like,
yeah, exactly.
I've talked about this on the show before. Like, I've done some stuff in a gorilla suit, and, like, very quickly.
Oh, dude.
Like, I mean, first of all, if you're at all claustrophobic, it's not even going to happen. It's just not going to happen. And if you're not claustrophobic, you will still feel a little bit of that. I mean, it's just the nature of things. But,
I mean, I have one of those inflatable Godzilla suits, like the
naturally. You know.
Yeah, and you know, it's kind of based off of the 2019 one, I think.
Right.
But even in there, like, I can't see much at all. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, the way it's, like, oh, right. I had to arrange it so I could see. And then, like you said, claustrophobia, like, I'm okay with it. But that suit has a flaw that it is, you can't really unzip it from the inside.
Oh, that's a problem.
Like, not easily.
Yeah.
And so... there was one time where I was like, I really kind of want to get out of the seat.
Yeah, yeah, I'm oh, having crap. A moment, right?
Like, can mm-hmm. somebody help me? Please, can somebody help me? Mm-hmm. Like, I can only imagine when it's foam.
Unbelievable. And, yeah.
Like, on top of you, and it weighs at least 100 pounds.
It's not
like,
breathing at all.
That
yeah.
can't
yeah.
That can't have been great.
Yeah. In my brief experience of, like, working with people wearing either costumes like this, like suits, or if you have an actor that's tied up in a scene... mm-hmm. the thing I always try to do is have always have someone whose only job it is to sort of watch them and make sure everything's cool, because
yep.
I've seen it happen, not on my stuff, but I've seen it happen where someone's cool with it. Someone's cool with it. And then suddenly they are really, really not cool with it. It's just a thing that happens with people sometimes, like a switch flips. And suddenly, like, yeah. you've got to get them loose. You've got to make them be able to move their hands. You've got to, you know, it's just yeah. human nature. It just happens to anybody, man.
Well, your brain is going, like, this is not natural.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
And you can suppress that. Like, and some people mm-hmm. can suppress it better than others. But once it really kicks in.
When the panic hits, it's, yeah, you can't stop it.
You have to have those people there to go, yep. whoa.
Make sure everyone's
stop fine. Filming. Like, yep. let's make sure everything's okay.
Everything stops and you help out the person. Yeah, of course. As I'm watching this, it's just these scenes of, you know, it's a double exposure where Godzilla's in the way in the distance stomping on stuff, and you've got these little people running in the foreground. And I'm telling you, like, you know, at it's an HD disc I'm watching, and it's blown up to, you know, it's a up-res to 4K watching on my TV, and it's dark enough that I'm telling you, I have no idea where the seam is. I have no idea what's mm-hmm. what's real and what's not. I have no idea. Yeah, it's just beautiful work.
They really played to the black, like the way they used the, you know, anything that you can do with black and white, the way they really used that contrast
yes.
to place everything right. in this was really amazing. I can't watch it. It's also interesting because I'd forgotten when I watched it again last night that it's not scope. It's like
it's Academy. It's like 4x3, which is fascinating, because when you think about the latter Godzilla films, when they bring them into Toho scope, which is 2.35,
right.
I think Toho scope's 2.35.
Like I can't remember. I have to look again.
Cinema scope's 2.39, and we're talking about when it's really widescreen, guys, and there's the black bars on top. That's because it's being shot anamorphically, which like. That's crazy. They started shooting this film anamorphically. So you actually need more light for anamorphic right. too. So there's that. But it always amazed me that they started making widescreen Godzilla movies, because you're talking about a character that is vertical, that's very vertical, that's like hundreds of feet tall mm-hmm. and narrow. And then you're going to squeeze that character into a much narrower frame, right? In much more elongated horizontal frame. The decision to do that, I think, was really fascinating. And obviously, widescreen was a way for them to try to combat the emergence of TV and try and get people to go to the theater instead of watching stuff at home, because you could see the spectacle of things.
I didn't mean to interrupt. But what's interesting, though, is that since that fits on a TV,
yeah,
like you can just show this with no pan and scan, no editing.
Of course,
like this movie fits on a TV, fine.
Exactly, and I think it adds to the feeling of less, it's less a cinematic experience and more almost pseudo documentarian, especially in these scenes. I think it really just, it feels like you're watching something someone filmed. And it really does let you see the scope of, like, Godzilla is miles away and he still towers over everything. It's just, I think this Godzilla size sort of varies a little bit within the film, depending on mm-hmm. how they're showing him. And sometimes he's definitely, you know, 100 to 200 feet tall or something like that. And sometimes he's maybe almost looks more like 1,000. Like sometimes he's massively big. And that's just the perspective and how things work down and stuff. But it's still keeping in mind that the real life people they're filming at 24 frames a second, and Godzilla, they're filming at a much slower speed, and those two things have to sync, right? It's madness. It's incredible. It's like Kong. You're just like, I can't even understand how you did this before the technology was there to, you know, check. You couldn't even check what you shot to see if it looks okay right away. You had to send it off to be developed and then get it back and then see if what you just shot. It baffles me. It almost terrifies me. It stresses me out to watch because I can't believe they were able to pull it off. It's so incredible.
I'm with you. And this has there's so many awesome elements in this, like the power line section of it. Where he's like going through power lines. There's tanks. He grabs the train, which is iconic, and it's interesting too because a version of the train scene. Also, those poor camera guys in the tower.
Oh, and that's the second raid. But yeah.
All of that stuff, which again is mirrored in -1, right? Mm-hmm. You have the guys on the building.
Of course, they really did the tribute to that,
And it was really nice to kind of come back and go, oh, look what they kept, look what they changed, look, all of that. Mm-hmm. Like
what they paid tribute to.
There's so much just brilliant work here that, it's something else.
And it never gets caught up in spectacle. It always comes back to right after that attack with, you know, we had all this like dynamic looking amazing special effects stuff. We go right to people being evacuated. And again, this almost like, you know, people going into shelters, people getting on trucks, people being shipped, whatever, because what they're going to do is, they're going to build this giant electrified fence and they're going to move everyone inland a little bit. And they're going to surround Tokyo Harbor with this giant fence that's got millions of volts in it. As a way to, they think that maybe that'll stop Godzilla. We have, you know, stock footage of like the, you know, the tanks and heavy machinery rolling out and doing the whole thing. But again, it keeps going back to the human cost, and it, you know, here we go back to, oh, he doesn't, because what's interesting, in the first attack, he doesn't use his atomic breath.
Right.
We don't see him do it. Like, that's something they hold off until the second attack where they're like, oh, no, it'll be, you know, we're ready for him. And then he pulls out this thing, which, you know, we didn't know he had that move, right? It's like his secret move in Mortal Kombat.
Yeah, it's also, I thought it was interesting because watching again, it's an aerosol.
Yeah.
Kind of feel
right
as opposed to eventually we become more and more of a special effect and becomes a more fire, more flame like, more flamethrower.
Yeah, this time it's almost like a spray that ignites. It's like a flamethrower kind of. It's fascinating.
I have, and it's funny too because I noticed, because I have a Godzilla humidifier.
Of course, so you do.
It becomes
as one does.
Well, when I saw that somebody made that, you know,
yeah, right. Of course,
I have to have that. And it has lights in it, so then it becomes like it lights up the aerosol.
Nice.
So it looks.
It looks blue. Like fire breath. Oh, that's pretty cool.
It looks like the blue. You know what we know as the kind of Showa era, blue flames, which was a genius move on whoever designed.
I think
thing,
that's clever,
right? And it. You know, when you turn it on, it makes the sounds and stuff like that. But it's interesting to see, like, oh, look, it's kind of like, I didn't think of it as period, you know, like, that's the period. But when you look at this, you go, oh, hey, this is original Godzilla. It is aerosol like that.
It is an aerosol thing. And that's one of the things I think that's also a puppet, too, because I think they have it rigged with a hose or something to spray out of the thing. But they don't, I think it was smart to obviously not have it be on fire just as it came out of the head of the actor or puppet, obviously, because you have a definite safety issue there. It's like the guy's not hot enough, right? Here we go. They're building this giant fence, and again, we go back to this small story, and it's maybe the thing in the movie I find funniest is that Hirito is talking to Emiko, and he's like, I'm going to ask your dad for your hand in marriage now. Okay. And she's warning her and she's like, okay. And Professor Yamane comes in, and Hirito manages to instantly get into an argument with him about whether Godzilla should be killed or not. And he's like, get out of my house. But then he storms out, and there's this moment where Hirito and Nimiko are like, yeah, that could have gone better.
Yeah, but again, that's what I was talking about before, those human moments of there's this
you
whole
need that.
Thing, like, there's a whole, Godzilla's affecting everything, but there's this this lead up to this marriage proposal and everything is time, you're right, but now that you've mentioned that, Godzilla ruins that too.
He ruins that, yes, exactly, he's messing up this guy's love life. They're all getting set up with the fence, and we have Godzilla's second, even like more intense attack. The first one was almost like he kind of wanders through like the industrial train area of the thing. It's like he almost passes through. You know, maybe it's just the fact that he it's like you say when you wear the costume, like Godzilla just can't see very well. He doesn't want to step on people's houses. He just can't see very well. maybe it's bad.
But he also doesn't have to to him, it's like anything. Like, we don't.
Yes.
As a human, you can't think about every anthill.
Of course. Like, yeah.
And if you do, like, now, I try to avoid snails and be, treat life as life. But it's, sometimes you step on a bug or a snail.
Right. And that's what humans are to him. He's
like,
Godzilla.
What are all these, like humans are just whatever is in his way.
Yeah, and I don't think he understands that these things he's wrecking are things these little creatures have made. Like, it's just a thing that's in his way. It doesn't, he's an animal that just works on instinct. He isn't, later on in the series, I think we see a slightly more self-aware Godzilla.
Right.
When he becomes, Japan's hero, obviously, and fights off all, Mechagodzilla and all that. King Ghidorah and everybody. But here he is, like I said, he's just a sheer force of instinct. Another trope the film is going to deliver here that becomes quite well used is this idea of these weapons of war are useless against Godzilla and science is the only way to go against him. The human mind being the best offensive weapon, I guess. But I also think there's a lot there in a culture that is so based around honor and dignity, the shame of having started a war and then lost it. Kind of looms large here too. And I think it's very poignant that they chose to show how useless their military is against this new threat to the country. It just, they shoot rockets at it. They shoot missiles. They shoot everything, cannons and everything like that. And nothing. After all the rockets and everything have bounced off him and not done anything, there's a guy trying to use a machine gun on him, which I love. It's just like, what do you think? Okay.
He's doing his part. Do it, man. Yeah. I don't know.
This Tommy gun is just going to
trying, right?
Yeah. He's just doing his part. not giving up. So we do have a much longer, extensive scene of Godzilla attacking the actual city, and now he's in the residential area and he's crushing buildings, and they're firing cannons at him and everything. And again, it's just more amazing, beautiful footage. Obviously, the electric fence thing that doesn't work very well, and here's where we see him first use the seat vision to melt the pylons that hold it up, and obviously render it useless. So yeah. Not so good. I don't know how they did this, where you see the giant towers turn white hot and melt. I'll bet that's on the documentary or something like that. I need to check that out. It's because that's cool looking.
Yeah.
Having said that, we do see just a little bit of personality. You got, so once he gets rid of that fence, he's like, yeah, there's just this little moment of like,
yeah,
I'll teach you. I mean, but it's like a line or something. Here's where we first see Godzilla's spines on the back of his back start glowing before he does his breath thing too, which becomes a big thing where you can see Godzilla's about to use his breath because the spine things are starting to glow. I think that plays into the Gareth Edwards American film too. They talk about that a lot.
I mean, it's such a great effect. And the fact that they're doing this, you know, with the techniques of the time,
hand frame by frame, right?
It just looks amazing. Yeah. it looks amazing.
Yeah.
It's so effective. I can't, can you imagine being in that crowd? And that's the first time you see that. Just go,
yeah.
Whoa.
That's a mind blowing.
Do you even comprehend those effects?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. It's so neat. Again, I mean, the extent when you see him walking down the one main street and you see the size of the model little town that they built, it just goes on for blocks and blocks and blocks. It just goes on and on and on. Like, there's so much care and detail put in this thing that is just going to be destroyed. I mean, it's only there to be destroyed, which is just kind of great. I mean, I guess I could keep talking about this Godzilla's attack on the city and stuff, but it's just, I mean, obviously if you've seen it, you've seen it. And if you haven't, then you should just watch it because it's just, words don't really do it. It's just, it's magical. It's just so, it's so awful, right? But there's this amazing beauty within the awfulness. And it's because of the craftsmanship that went into the making of the thing. Most notably the scene that I always forget the little bit with the mom with the three kids saying, okay, we're going to, they're crouched in the building and there's ashes falling everywhere. And she's like, we're going to see your dad soon, which is just,
oh, devastating.
Like, dude, like,
absolutely devastating.
Like, Godzilla does. I mean, nowhere in the Frankenstein films does Frankenstein kill well, I guess he kills the little girl, but he doesn't mean to. But the viciousness of Godzilla, like, not just not caring about humans and just killing kids and hurting kids and irradiating little kids, you know, just not caring. It's nightmarish. It's really nightmarish. And obviously it's plucked right out of a very recent nightmare that people in Japan had experienced. Yeah. And then we, you know, when you, I think the moment, one of my favorite bits is the, what I call the bottle rocket scene, right? Where he's going out in the harbor and he's finally leaving. And then the planes show up and they start shooting the missiles at him. Yes, you see the wires and you see, you know, they definitely look like little sparkly rockets going past the guy in the, going past, Nakajima is on in the suit. But I love these, like, I'm not saying I'm going to go on about it, but I just saw it's a shot where, like, you see this burning city and you just see this little tiny silhouette of Godzilla in the distance. Like, he's miles and miles away, just walking across the city.
It sets such an intense sense of scale.
Yeah. Yeah.
In it all. And they do a really masterful job of continuously showing you what the scale of destruction is, what the scale of Godzilla is. Like, placing him in the scene correctly.
Yeah. And I think showing landmarks, like, they show, like, the one, is it the theater building? And they had a big deal with this in Godzilla Minus One, too. It's the big round building that's in downtown. I think it's in Ginza. And they show Godzilla next to it. So I think someone in Japan would be like, oh, I've seen that theater. I know how big that theater is. That's how big Godzilla is. So, you know, it's by perspective.
So my friend Hiro actually told me when he would, you know, send me the latest Godzilla movies back when we were in college. He's like, notice. So what became a trope was Godzilla destroying the latest, coolest building.
Right, of course.
So if you go back and look, and I was like, oh, what, that building? I was like, yeah, they just completed that in the past, you know, couple years. Mm-hmm. And so as you go through that, the 90s era and on, you'll notice. And it's the same idea. So it's, you know, it's here, it's to put it in a place, like, that's,
of course, this
area in Tokyo.
The reality,
but eventually it becomes the kind of nudge wink.
Yeah.
That when he attacks Tokyo or wherever he's attacking, he's gonna, in that whatever city that is,
what's this,
he's gonna attack the latest, newest, coolest thing.
That's, it's kind of funny. Like, oh, here we go.
And I was like, oh, so I started looking, after he mentioned that, I started looking like, oh, okay, I get it.
Yeah.
And that's stuck with me because it's just a little trivia bit that I wouldn't have known unless somebody pointed it out. And it is cool to go back and watch those and kind of see, like, oh, okay, I get it. The coolest landmark Godzilla's going to get rid of.
Yes. And that follows in all the way down to Independence Day and Armageddon and, you know, more recent
things
where, like you see the White House or the the U.S. Bank building in L.A. or the mm-hmm. Empire State Building get destroyed. And obviously that, you know, King Kong did that first, where it's like they picked a notable landmark that people recognized and used it as a plot device for the film. And I thought that was a bit of brilliant.
Exactly.
I'm at the point where there's all the news people on the radio tower way up high filming the perspective of Godzilla doing it, and Godzilla comes and turns on them and comes at them. And I don't know if you've ever thought this, but the time I've been to Tokyo, there's the very tall, very obvious, notable red and white tower there, mm-hmm. you know. And I always think like, well, they must have had to build that after Godzilla wrecked the first one.
Right.
It's the rebuild. I don't know the name of that tower. You see it everywhere when you're in Tokyo.
Is it not just Tokyo Tower?
Is that Tokyo Tower? Okay, yeah, I think you're right. There's this eerie moments where there's not the Godzilla march, and there's even no audio, and it is just this moment of like Godzilla just, you know, walking silently through the devastation, and you know, it's just eerie. Serizawa was watching it on TV, you know, so we check in with him. It's you know, it's interesting because it's in, you know, just 10 years before, you would never have been able to do a scene where your main characters are watching something that is not happening near them in real time, right? It's only because of the advent of television where you can have these characters kind of being able to see the destruction of what's happening from a place of safety.
Yeah. You know, also, it's amazing too, because there's so many firsts in this. Like, King Kong obviously set the tone. Yes. But even Godzilla's footstep sounds begin to inform us, this is what a giant monster sounds
right.
like.
Yes, of course.
Like, we had Kong before this, but I think
but that Kong is 25 Godzilla's, or 40 feet tall. Godzilla's
yeah.
an order
Godzilla
bigger.
Begins to just tell us the language of what a giant mm-hmm. monster sounds mm-hmm. like from here on out.
Yeah, this is how it's done. Yeah, absolutely. it informs our reality of like our perception of like this is what it would be. So, you know, Emiko is helping at like a makeshift hospital, taking care of people. And here's where we see that awful scene where they hold the Geiger counter up to this little boy and he's totally irradiated. So, you know, anyway. And she's seeing all these horrors. She's seeing a mom, the body of a mother being taken away from her crying kids and stuff. She's very overwhelmed. And when Hidetō shows up, she makes the decision that she's going to betray Sarazawa's confidence and tell him about the oxygen destruction machine. Because again, Sarazawa swore her to secrecy, like made no mistake. Like you can never tell anybody this. And she's like, I promise I will never tell anybody this, when of course she does, but you know, it's for this good. So she and, Hidetō are going to go visit Sarazawa. And Hidetō is going to try to convince him to allow them to use his device. Sarazawa says no. Hidetō doesn't take no for an answer. And then the two guys sort of break into fisticuffs.
Right.
Which we don't see the whole fight, but Hidetō gets the worst of it, because he gets knocked in the head and he's bloody. And we have, it's not a flaw of the film, and I'm not going to be critical and stuff, but after, you know, what we just saw, the spectacle of everything, the devastation, we know we're kind of getting towards the end. There is about a 6 or 7 minute sort of sit down conversation scene with Sarazawa, where they're trying to convince him to let him use the thing. And he keeps talking about whatever. And the dialogue sort of goes around a couple times and comes back to where it started. You know what I mean? It's sort of, mm-hmm. it's the nature of the argument that they're trying to get him to see their perspective of the thing. But you know, it's necessary, I think, for the story, because Sarazawa has to get past this idea where, like he says, like he's created a thing that has immense destructive power, and he knows, and to your point, Tony, like you said, if he has worked for governments before, he knows that he won't be able to just use it on Godzilla and say, okay, you can never use it again. The governments will make him give over the formula and so they can exploit it and use it. And he doesn't want to be that character. And I don't think I ever made this connection before, but after obviously the big to-do about Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer movie this year, now I look at Sarah Zawinul, like, he's kind of an Oppenheimer. He actually is like this brilliant scientist who has created something absolutely awful and is horrified at the idea that other people are going to take what he was trying to do, you know, this scientific breakthrough that he's great and use it to hurt people. He's absolutely Japanese Oppenheimer. And it's so interesting that I never made that connection until obviously the film, which,
yeah. And not only that, but as we move towards him deciding, yes, I'm going to destroy my notes so that when I use it, it's this one time only. Yes. But especially after you've seen it once, you can see the change where he's like, I'm not coming back from this.
Yes, like, absolutely.
I have to be the last person to use this.
Yes. Yeah.
And that
he's made that decision already. And he's not going to share it with her or anything. You know,
that's heavy.
It is. It's really like he's reached, but by the time he says yes, he's decided that he's going to die. And, I think it's Ridley Scott said that, if one of your main characters is going to die at the end of the film, they have to have been kind of dying the whole movie. And when you see in Sarazawa is that he's obviously compromised by what happened to him in the war. He's physically harmed and damaged. He's emotionally, you know, conflicted by all these things. He's also like the third wheel now, cause he can kind of see where things are going with Emiko and Hidetō. So he knows like he has nothing to live for, you know? He's like Russell Crowe at the end of Gladiator, where I think that's what, Ridley Scott was referring to is, you know, Maximus's family is killed. So he's sort of died there. And now he's just biding time until the end of Gladiator, where spoilers, anyway, gets killed by,
think also it's not just he's been preparing because we've seen it before. We talked about it earlier where he realizes like he is not equipped to be with her anymore.
Right.
For a variety of reasons. Course.
No, exactly.
Like, yes, there was a spark and maybe there could be some saving, but I think he himself sees himself as too far gone.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think he thinks there's a place in the world for him anymore, really. You know what I mean? Cause he already lives Absolutely. Like a hermit, you know, he doesn't socialize. He doesn't, you know, I don't think he has like a bingo club or anything, you know, I think he's, So he has already started to move away. And that's, like I said, the quote, I think it applies very well. So he finally agrees. I always forget the song where they have all the school children singing on the radio and they all sit and listen, like the three characters all sit and listen to this very beautiful melody that they're singing, as a way of trying to encourage hope and stuff in the Japanese people after all these bad things have been happening. He finally agrees. And the plan is they're going to go out on a boat and they're going to take the oxygen destroying device. They're using a Geiger counter to find out where Godzilla is sleeping underwater. So apparently, or just hanging out in the ocean. And then I think the plan was originally that Ogata is going to go down with the thing and set it off and get it out of there and kill Godzilla. And here's the moment where Sarazawa is like, I'm going down too. And Ogata's like, this is the most aggressive I've seen Ogata be. He's like, you don't know how to dive. Like, no, he's like, absolutely not. Cause this is what you have to keep in mind. This is what, Hidetō does. He's a deep sea salvage guy. This is his job. He knows how to scuba dive. This is his whole, or go down in an iron lung or whatever the equivalent is at this point. Sarazawa insists, and Hidetō's like, okay, well, fine, we'll go down together and set off the thing as a team. So that's the plan. So they both suit up to go down. And my favorite thing is that Sarazawa keeps his eye patch on. I don't know why.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I guess there's no reason why he wouldn't, but Yeah, it's just, I don't know. He's in a scuba gear, but he's also wearing an eye patch. It just cracks me up. I guess
it's, I mean, it looks cool. Yeah. Regardless.
Well, I will say, like, what it does is when they're in these masks and you only see like a little circle of their face, you have no trouble figuring out who's who. So
sure.
So
by the way, this whole sequence, again, another thing that hit home this time is, it's terrifying enough to see Godzilla when you can run around.
Yeah.
But when he's kind of just leisurely, you know, through water coming at you.
Unbelievable.
Even if you're kind of prepared, like, okay, we have an oxygen destroyer on our side. Hey, right. You don't know for a fact if it's going to work.
Exactly.
Right? They're just hoping that this thing's going to work. But you can't readily, even if you thought you could escape. Plus, we've already established that he's irradiated. So I bet the water is getting hotter.
Oh, right.
There's radiation. Like, all, like, they're closer than most people have been to Godzilla.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially by choice.
Unless they're like underfoot. Yeah.
Right. And so he's coming towards them. And
it's so creepy.
Even if you could, it's like we were talking about earlier, even if you can process this, your brain's got to be going, I'm underwater. This sucks.
Yeah.
I'm not supposed to be here.
Exactly.
Because those suits are terrible. And yeah, then you're also going, look in the distance, a Godzilla. Oh, wait, not so much.
Like, yeah, it's coming. Yeah, exactly. And you really see the scale, too, because they're just standing on the ground and Godzilla's coming at him. He's hundreds of feet taller than them. It's unbelievable.
Like, your brain is not meant to process that.
No, exactly.
That is terrifying.
It's like the Lovecraftian thing where, like, sometimes you see something so awful, your brain just, like, breaks and you just lose your mind.
Exactly.
Right? You know, the press is there. Sort of narrating for the public what's going on as they suit up and they're getting ready to go down. I think it's fun that Hirito is wearing the same headband, like sweat rag thing,
mm-hmm.
that the Godzilla suit wearers, like Nakajima, you always see wearing. Like, I think it's like where it's tied in the front, which is a very traditional thing to do, I think, in Japan when you're doing some kind of labor or something. But obviously the purpose of that is to keep the sweat off from running down his face into his eyes.
Well, you can't wipe it away in the
suit. Of course, because you're inside the helmet, yeah. But I just think, yeah, there's this little, almost like a nod there.
Sure.
Yeah, they go down, and we do have a couple, like, they did it a couple different ways. I don't know. I think they built an underwater set, right, with the undersea terrain. And then they had the guy in the Godzilla suit, because obviously they did not put a guy in a Godzilla suit underwater. Because first of all, you know, how's he going to breathe? Second of all, once all that latex gets wet, it's going to weigh like 7 times what it would normally weigh. And even underwater, I think the whole thing would have been a mess. So I think what they're doing is filming through a filter, or maybe they have some kind of clear tank of water in front of the camera that they're filming through onto a dry set. So they're doing dry for wet, which is what we call now. And of course, under cranking, right. so or over cranking. So it's going slow. But these are nightmare scenes. Cause the other thing to me is, like, you're kind of seeing Godzilla more in his element. Like, this, like, Godzilla more belongs here underwater than he does walking around Tokyo. Obviously, like, this is this primordial setting, and you see, like, this massive creature and stuff. Having said that, they actually do, I mean, obviously they're filming real divers underwater in some kind of tank or some kind of thing. I don't know where they shot this, if there was some kind of aquarium or something like that, because the water is very clear. So I don't know, you know, how they manage this. Because it's almost like a creature from the Black Lagoon kind of thing. But yeah. And as we said, you know, obviously they see Godzilla, he gets close enough, they set off the thing. Hirito goes back up to the surface and only then realizes that Sarazawa has not followed, and Sarazawa is going to stay here and see this thing finished himself. And obviously, as we said, we realize this was always his plan. This, you know, he's not improvising. This is his thing. And again, like, as I said before, like, I do think he sees himself as a monster. So there's this, in a way, like, there's this final showdown. And he's getting rid of the device that he's worried about everyone using, that's going to use it once. It's a measure of how desperate everybody is, right? Because if they're going to kill Godzilla, but they are also going to kill every living thing in Tokyo Harbor, right? Like,
yeah, like, that always this is, struck me.
This isn't, it's like, this isn't going to be good for the local ecology. This is a thing.
Yeah, it's not going to recover for decades. Yeah.
Probably. I mean, Godzilla's already destroyed their fishing industry, so but now they're actually destroying the fish.
To be fair, though, anything in that area is also now contaminated with radiation.
This is true. You're right. You're right.
It so, like so it's a loss regardless.
No matter what, that's true. It's just like yeah, all the fish and stuff. No one's eating sushi for a while from Tokyo Harbor. Serizawa sets it off, and it does it, and we have this kind of you want to talk about this last moment where the thing's going off, and Godzilla's like, I mean, and he comes up above the water one last time, and he screams, and we hear this vocalization and stuff, and it's just this death scream, and it's the moment where you really do feel bad for Godzilla, right?
That, you know, a lot has been talked about the creation of the roar and how it was glove and contrabass string and all that, but this time, I don't think enough people remember this just horrifying version of that sound. Yeah. His death scream is just pure pain.
It's anguish.
Anguish. Yeah. And I hadn't thought about that in forever. It was like,
right.
You know, this, when I, listened to it on a really good system and everything, like, wow. I don't think enough people remember or give credit to, there's the iconic roar.
Right, right.
But boy, does this death scream go hard.
This is something like slightly different.
It is just...
They took the moment to actually make that vocalization something else.
Agonizing. Yeah. And it's not a repeat. It's its own just like terrifying, anguished death roar. Right. And I think that deserves to be up there with the traditional Godzilla roar as far as iconic moments.
Yeah, it reminds me of this was an episode you were on, I believe, wasn't it, Tony, with Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman? I'm sorry, it's not. It's this was Son of Frankenstein, and it's when Igor is killed and the monster finds him. And Karloff lets off like a wail, finding him dead.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
A very human wail, not a growl, not everything. Like it sounds like a person's crying. And it's just like, whoa! Like this fun little spooky movie just got kind of real and kind of ugly for a second. You know what I mean? Like, a whole thing. Yeah. Godzilla goes down to the bottom, and we do see a moment where he. His body, all the flesh melts off, and he turns into a giant Godzilla sized skeleton, at the bottom of the ocean. And
that skeleton gets used, sort of in the building of Mechagodzilla in the 2000s.
I was going to ask you if that was a thing. I wasn't sure. I had a feeling, yeah, I knew it like played out into something else, but I don't remember what. So that makes sense. Well, there.
Yeah, the bones of
Godzilla.
Mechagodzilla has the bones, and we're kind of led to believe that it's these bones. But everything kind of gets a little nebulous. But it's a nice nod to like, when we use the oxygen destroyer on the original, he was just bones, and we found those bones, and then
makes sense.
So there's a Godzilla. There's a Godzilla actually inside Mechagodzilla.
Some DNA or something. That's interesting.
It's like parts of the bones are in there, and there's a whole thing with that. But you see him excavating in that film. You see them excavating some of that. But it's cool that it's most likely it's this Godzilla.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
Or there's a nod to being that, makes even sense. If they don't explicitly say like, oh, this. And they might even reference it, but I need to go back. I periodically go back through. So
yeah, I have not.
When
really
you watch, I think that's the double edged sword of. Yeah, it's double edged sword of when you watch a lot of movies. Like
yes,
I'm not the most encyclopedic person. I try to be, but I'd have to go back and look at the dialogue and see if they go. Oh yeah, oxygen destroyer.
Yeah,
because
they blur together when you watch them all. I was talking that happened to me. I watched all the Roger Corman Poe movies with Vincent Price like in a week. I kept renting them, and now I can't remember which one was which because they all blurred together. So Masquerade Death and everything else, Witchhunter General. My favorite thing about the end of this movie is that it's a Pyrrhic victory for our heroes, where, you know, everybody, all the reporters, everybody's cheering, like, Godzilla's dead, we did it, we're gonna save him, like that. And all the main characters are miserable. They're all heartbroken because of Sarazawa. And Yamane is heartbroken because of Godzilla itself. So, you know, while the world celebrates, the people who actually delivered that victory to the world are devastated, you know? And it's such a good, it's very poetic, and it's just beautifully executed, beautifully acted. I do want to say, like, I know like you said, Tony, like, some of the performances, they can come off melodramatic to a modern eye and ear. And I think, yeah, you have to understand there's a different sort of theatrical acting style in Japan, and also in 1950s Japan than now. Just like if you watch like the Philadelphia Story with Jimmy Stewart and Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant, like, that acting style is much different from what you would see in a modern film. Things change and evolve, and tastes change. But having said that, like, there's not a weak, cheesy moment. That's what I want to say. There's not a cheesy moment of performance in this whole thing. Everybody doing this movie was taking this thing dead serious. Mm-hmm. Like, every actor, it's everyone is committed. Everyone is playing the reality of the situation in a very modern way. And I think that's why, yeah, despite that, I will say, I think you can go back and watch this movie and absolutely understand all the characters' motivations, all the conflicts and everything. And it feels like someone could have written this movie yesterday, you know. The writing and themes and everything don't date in the slightest bit. Obviously, it was shot when it was shot, but yeah, just beautiful.
I agree. And I think, again, we've talked about how it's a catharsis movie, but also, like, it's still, the themes are still relevant.
Yeah.
And it does bug me when people, I understand everybody processes movies differently, but not being able to handle melodrama, like, when, you know, because I saw this as a newly restored print, and seeing that in the theater and have people kind of giggle, yeah, and do all that was just kind of like, oh man, like, I get it, but also can we understand the nature of film and, like, place ourselves in that time period?
Yes. Well, I think some people can do that and some people don't. And the people that can't obviously don't listen to the Borgo Pass Horror Podcast. So there we go.
by the way, Godzilla against Mechagodzilla is the one that, and it does, you know, they do excavate the bones,
which we kind of saw dissolve, but, you know, hey, it's okay.
There's a whole thing with that, that's in there, which is awesome.
It's cool. I don't foresee us covering any of the other Godzilla movies on thing. I mean, I know Godzilla Raids Again is also black and white, so it maybe comes a little bit under our purview. But I do think this is just the shining example of this incarnation of this new genre of film that this movie started. And you know, again, with all the hype about Godzilla Minus One, which I love, by the way, and if I haven't mentioned, I'd call it my favorite film of the year, and next to this, it is absolutely my favorite Godzilla film. I think if anyone hasn't seen it yet, it is such a love letter to this particular film, more than the Godzilla franchise in general. Like, this one film, it is just, and what they're able to do with so little money compared to a Hollywood film, the special effects and the humanity of it is the thing that just connects that movie to this movie so well to me.
Yeah, did you see it in black and white as well?
I have not seen the black and white version. I cannot wait to do.
It's pretty nice. I know some people I know had some quibbles with it, and
interesting. I was filming that. I really enjoyed it. I was back in Jersey making.
No, it's hard. It was. I happened to be able to go to a theater where I could go late at night.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, going to the Draft House here, there's one not too far from me. I asked, like, hey, are we showing that? We got a short window to do that.
Yes, yeah.
But I think they did a really great job. I think they, maybe it's not perfect, but it's done really well. And I think in a lot of the scenes at night, they definitely pulled the color in and contrast in a way that you would do nighttime scenes in black and white.
Right. Because obviously, like, it was filmed in color and they're making it black and white.
Right. And so there were some spots where I noticed, like, it wasn't, the thing is, they didn't just, like, take all the tint out, right? Like pull the saturation bar down.
No, like, you can't do that.
That's
yeah.
the easy way to do it, right?
Like, then you have to deal with contrast and everything, because when you film in color, you're depending on the color to separate things, different color things. And then when you go monochromatic, I'm as a guy who's just about to start on a project where I'm going to shoot in color and make it black and white. Trust me, this is very much foremost in my mind, how to do this.
I definitely think as you're doing that, if you want to see a good textbook case, you know, Miller, although did that for the Chrome version of Mad Max. Fury Road, and I think that was cool too. Because he wanted it to be black and white.
That's so cool.
It's and it's such a weird dichotomy too, to get something that's that saturated, it's that colorful, in its color form, and then take it all the way back down. But I think minus color actually does an even better job. Again, some of it, what I thought was interesting, I'm probably, as a film nerd and person who pays maybe more attention to the cinematography aspect of it, like, I was probably looking for more of the, like, oh, that does feel like nighttime or close. Like, they're doing these nice tweaks.
Right.
It still looks very modern. It wasn't like they added extra film grain. And why would they? No, like, that wasn't the point. But I thought that they really, somebody who knew their craft.
That's great.
Really took the time. And if you can, I'm hoping that they include it with whatever physical release that we get.
Yes.
Like sometime this year. At some
point, when they figure out the legal stuff between Toho and the American things. There's this whole, problem.
I think we're on the way.
The distribution, I know. Butting up against Godzilla and Kong, King of Whatevers or something.
Yeah. But unfortunately, it was a small run of time. But if you get a chance, I do recommend it. Not everybody's going to want to kind of partake in that exercise, right?
Yeah, of course, no. But
but I thought,
I feel like our listeners would be interested in this, obviously, as a modern film that's taking back to black and white. Because I talk about black and white a lot on the show, obviously, where, like, you know, there's black and white, like what they shot Murders in the Rue Morgue in 32, like, and then there's black and white, like what they shot The Invisible Man Returns in the 40s. And I talk about black and white, and I talk about gray scale. And a lot of those 40 movies get very gray scale. And what I'm hoping to do with my next thing is to go back to like a very more high key black and white. And Godzilla is a great example. The 54 here is really it's a pretty stark black and white film. It's very, the contrast is very intense. There's bright whites and dark darks.
You're getting into, like, also at that point with our modern tools, you know, good luck on, you're going to have to design the costumes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, to take advantage, like all the, there's a, people don't, not everybody will understand, like, hey, this, you know, how you costume, the colors you use and how you costume that.
Yeah, red is a nightmare in black and white. Red, you never know how a red, something red is going to look in black and white. Is it going to look black? Is it going to look, you know, white or gray or something like that? Yeah, it's a whole thing. So, yeah,
you know, the thing that I come back to, this is a little bit of a tangent, but it's something I keep thinking about when we're talking about special effects and especially special effects in black and white. I got to see a long time ago a really, really nice print of Faust. Mm. And what struck me, I think, was that
that's
20s?
Yeah, it's 20s. It's the Nosferatu guy.
Yeah. So
yeah,
here's
blanking on it, but yeah.
But what struck me was this was, you know, now, currently, over 100 years ago, right? And there's a scene of the demon above the village. And when you see the print of it. Yeah.
Yes. That famous one of him over the village. Yeah.
And you look at, like, this is, and I don't mean this as a knock, by the way. Like, you do what you can with the budget and everything. But when I saw that, and I go, why do some movies look cheap? And I don't mean expensive. I mean, they look cheap.
Yeah.
And then you compare that. Like, this was, and now granted, this was a person, this was the studio film of the time, right? Like, let's think about it as, like, this is a Spielberg, you know, you name, whatever, whoever you want to name that you think of as big budget, right? So, But that scene looks so amazing.
So good. It's just iconic. It's
and incredible. You kind of like, and I can't say that I can make something like that, right? This is a reflection on me as well. But when you see movies, you're like, wow, that is craftsmanship. Like, this shows who has craftsmanship, who has vision,
yes,
et cetera. Because that image, that scene holds up.
Oh, and it's an,
you can watch, like, you can go to Tubi now and just watch so many movies that don't even hold a candle to that.
Yeah. Well, it's
in, and that's in black and white and 100 years exactly. ago. And so that's, it really kind of changed my thinking as far as like how I view effects and how I view, directors, how I view cinematography and to strive for that in how I view things. Now, again, sometimes you can't let perfection get in the way of completing a thing.
Yes. I know that well enough from my films, yes.
As an artist.
You can hold off on perfection indefinitely, but at some point you do have to finish your project.
Yeah. But I really did think about that. Yeah. And as I move, as we move towards, hey, okay, yeah, this is a man in a suit, but look at how it is placed. And look at how complete of an image this is.
It's how iconic that's going to be. It's how it connects to the viewer, right?
Yeah.
It's there's perfection, and then there's something else. And Godzilla just has all those single shots that you're just like, whoa. Like we go back to just this one of him first coming up over the top of the island in Odo Island, and you're like, mm-hmm. that's there it is. It's right there. And it says so much. You're like, that. Look at the size of that thing. Look at it. Look at how it's on top of a hill and people are lower down on a hill. So it's mm-hmm. it's not only is it really tall, but it's above, it's lurking above them too. They're vulnerable. It's not down below them and they're looking down at it. It's he's high above and it's all those things. And sometimes there's just a kismet to it, right? Like you come up with some visual idea and something just connects with the viewer. And it's, like there's many more cinematic shots in Jaws, but the shot of the girl holding onto the buoy in the beginning is so, where we never see the shark, yeah. is so perfect that you're like, I get it, and it sells the terror and it sells the danger and everything. Yeah, absolutely. So okay guys, this might be a two-parter. We're gonna see how this shakes out once I hit stop. but if there's anything worth a two-parter, it's definitely this movie, because it's just absolutely, and I love the heck out of it. And I'm so glad, Tony, 32 years after we met, we got to sit down and do a podcast episode talking about the one and only Godzilla. Is there's a kismet to that too. I think that's really great. Thank you so much for coming on and doing this one with me.
The power of friendship and
Godzilla.
Fate yes, perhaps,
yes,
right?
Yes, like I think
the
so.
Fact that we've known each other all these years. I have a question for you. Do you still have the illustration of Godzilla that you did, that you used that model that you gave to me?
You know what? I don't have much of that artwork. That ended up getting stored somewhere and that place got pulled away and stuff like that. So no, the answer is no. I forgot I did that. That's right. I had, for one of my illustration classes, I had to do a Godzilla toy illustration.
We've talked about it before, but I still, that toy has been in every car.
That's awesome.
That I've been in, and it's in my current vehicle.
Godzilla is my co-pilot.
Exactly. I actually where I used to get my oil changed, that one time I took it out because I was changing things, and the guy goes, oh, I'm so, I, at first I didn't know if that was your car, because I'm so used to seeing the Godzilla in that every time. So, iconic. And that was the same Godzilla. He's survived Texas heat.
That's amazing.
He's survived multiple travels.
Built toy from KB Toys or wherever it was from back in the day, which probably doesn't even exist anymore either. So outlived some things. So, oh, that's cool.
But what a great turnaround that is. That survived and our friendship survived. How amazing.
Right? I know. It's great. It's so wonderful. And thanks to the technology that lets you be in Austin and me be in LA, and we can have a conversation and this and record it.
Oh, yeah.
And then it can go out everywhere. Everybody, this episode is going to drop, probably, or at least the first half, it'll probably drop tomorrow because we're due for a new episode. And Livio's been out of town for a while. So we're filling in a bit with his kids. He's been on vacay. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We have a ton of back episodes, like 75 now at this point or something, in our library. We're available if you're not listening to this on your favorite podcast platform. We are probably available on it. Give us a check at Borgo Pass Horror Podcast. Tons of stuff to listen to. We're also very active on our Facebook and Instagram pages under Borgo Pass. So give us a check out. Tony Savaggio, thanks so much for being here. This is Jim Towns. Everybody, thank you so much for listening to this episode on Godzilla. We will see you next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode, but the fun does not stop here. You can follow and interact with the show's hosts and listeners online on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. The Borgo Pass Horror Podcast is a presentation of Shadow Camera Film and Entertainment. This episode was edited by Livio Marino. The music was composed by Sean Poole. Opening and closing narration are by me, Kat Ahrens. Show titles and graphics created by Jim Towns. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Borgo Pass Horror Podcast.